loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the news of the day. First, the NSA has deleted surveillance data, and the FBI has deleted text messages between two FBI employees criticizing President Trump that a judge had ordered them to preserve. NSA said disingenuously that it didn't have the storage space to hold the data. The FBI said the deletion was an accident. Next, Twitter on Friday began emailing more than 677,000 people to tell them that they may have interacted with several thousand accounts that Twitter has linked to a Russian bot farm. What was in the automated tweets, and did they sway voters or opinion makers during the election? Then the United States is arming and training neo-Nazis in Ukraine, all while Congress is debating a prohibition on doing just that. And then, just days after the Trump administration announced that it would allow states to compel poor people to work in order to get health care under Medicaid, federal health officials granted Kentucky permission to impose those requirements. And finally, President Trump's new national defense strategy envisions a world where great power competition with China and Russia is a bigger threat to the U.S. than terrorism. Have we entered into a new national defense era? That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to NSA and the FBI. Those two organizations have deleted surveillance data and text messages between two FBI employees criticizing President Trump that a judge had ordered them to preserve. NSA said disingenuously that it didn't have the storage space to hold the information. The FBI said the deletion was an accident, in quotes. We're joined from Maryland by Bill Binney. Bill is a former NSA technical director who became a legendary national security whistleblower. Bill, one quick question for you to start this off. When I had my own little kerfuffle with the FBI and they confiscated all of my electronics, they were able to retrieve emails that I had deleted a decade earlier. So how is it possible to just lose or to delete data?
Well, I mean, it's only illogical if you deliberately do it and destroy all the hardware associated with it, too. That's the only way to do it, you know?
Right. That makes sense. If you destroy the device on which it was stored, then it's going to be gone forever. And you would have to make a conscious decision to destroy it.
That's right. I would also point out, you know, my background is mathematics, okay? And that was where I used a lot of mathematics when I worked at NSA. And I just sit here and listen to this story coming across the line here about the FBI and NSA. And I just say, what is the random probability, just the random probability of these two agencies deleting similar material, that is material that's involved in an investigation of some sort or another? What's the random probability of them doing that? And I would say about zero.
Yeah, just about zero, especially after having been told by a federal judge to preserve the information.
So we're talking about data that has what the FBI deletion of data relates to text messages between FBI agents who were tasked with investigating the Hillary Clinton email server issue and then who were involved in the so-called Russia probe. We're going to talk about that too, but let's first focus on the NSA. Since 2007, the NSA has been under court orders to preserve data about certain of its surveillance efforts following the revelation of those surveillance efforts around 2007, 2008. Now they've told the NSA recently told U.S. District Judge Jeffrey White in a filing, this was on last Thursday night, and another little notice submission, according to Politico last year, that the agency did not preserve the content of internet communications intercepted between 2001 and 2007 under the program Bush ordered. To make matters worse, backup tapes that might have mitigated the failure were erased in 2009, 2011, and 2016, according to the NSA.
Crazy.
Go ahead, Bill.
I was just saying, figure the random probability of that being done over and over and over again. I mean, any judge that would buy that is just a real sucker. You know, they're just either they're outright stupid or they're a part of the cover-up. This is a direct cover-up. I mean, it's very clear to me. I mean, I'm just a country boy, and as I explained it to one of my friends, you know, I can spot a chip in the field a mile away. And this is one big, fat, juicy, smelly chip, you know?
Yeah, and there's normally there would be court penalties.
Absolutely.
There'd be sanctions or even contempt.
But they're in violation of the Records Act, too. I mean, they're required to keep that stuff.
So, Bill, when NSA says, and I'm looking at a statement that NSA released, it says, the NSA's review to date reveals that this presidential surveillance program, internet content data, was not specifically targeted for deletion, but rather the PSP internet content data matched criteria that were broadly used to delete data of a certain type in response to mission requirements, and this is the great part, to free up space and to improve performance of the backup system.
They don't have enough room.
Yeah, they don't have enough space. Can that possibly be true?
No, of course not. I mean, they just brought online that million square foot storage facility in Bluffdale, Utah, and they are building another one, 2.8 million square feet, over here on Fort Meade. They started that one in 2016. So they've got plenty of space. Plus, that doesn't count the 8 acres of computers under the building, another supercomputer building, and all storage down in San Antonio and Fort Gordon, Georgia, and Hawaii, and all around the world. Doesn't count all that storage either.
But according to the NSA, here they are under order from a court. Don't destroy this data. Do not destroy this data, because it's talking about what the NSA did between 2001 and 2007, when the American people did not know that the NSA was engaged in mass data bulk surveillance of all of our communications. But when it came to this order, they had to clear the space to make room for other data. I mean, it's not plausible.
It's not plausible. And then NSA has the unmitigated gall to tell the judge, and I quote, the NSA has no reason to believe at this time that PSP internet content data was specifically targeted for deletion.
Well, obviously they did, because they had rules to go at it and delete it.
That's right.
Targeting. So, I mean, that's just an outright fabrication on their part. These are all lies they're feeding the court, hoping they'll believe them, because generally judges don't know diddly squat about, national security or data storage from NSA or any technology. They're usually just out there saying, well, tell me what I should do. That's fundamentally what the FISA court does anyway.
Let's turn for a moment to the FBI.
Yep.
Here's from Reuters. The Federal Bureau of Investigation has lost about 5 months' worth of text messages between two staffers who worked on probes into former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's emails and possible collusion between Russia and President Donald Trump's 2016 presidential campaign. Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson, who chairs the Senate Homeland Security Committee, revealed in a January 20th letter that the FBI technical system failed to preserve texts that were exchanged between Lisa Page, a lawyer, and Peter Strozak, an agent, between mid-December 2016 through mid-May of 2017. Now, these, we know from other accounts, these texts were by exchange between Page and Strozak. They were both working on the Hillary Clinton campaign. They were both actually hostile to the Trump campaign. They were part of the Mueller-Trump-Russia collusion. They talked about the interrogation or the investigation as being, quote, an insurance program against Trump. They were clearly hostile. They had animus to Trump. And now, what's the random possibility, since we're talking about mathematical possibilities, of all of these texts being deleted? Go ahead, Bill.
Well, I say the random probability is zero on all of it, simply because not only if they're going to delete the evidence in FBI, they also, since it's text messages going across the net, they also have to delete it in NSA. So they got to do both those agencies. And to do the same kind of similar data in both cases, that is data relevant to an investigation, that is just virtually impossible randomly.
Yeah, so that's an important point. Go ahead, John.
That is an important point. And I'm going to make another point, too. It's a little bit more broad. But, this story was broken over the weekend by the Daily Caller, which is an extreme right-wing, like alt-right news website. This was not broken by anyone in the mainstream media. It ought to have been, because what we're talking about here is government oversight. We're talking about the congressional oversight committees that are supposed to be, or in this case, at least trying to do their jobs. So this
is... they aren't even doing that, John.
And they're not. They're not. Because, you know, the oversight committee should have been so deeply involved in this issue that it would have been impossible to delete the information because they would have been all over it, let alone to delete it three or four separate times.
And Bill Binney is saying that if the FBI, in fact, did suffer from a technical system failure, which is what the FBI is asserting, the NSA would still have that data. We have 1 minute left, Bill, right? So in other words, the NSA would have had to also, in duplicate, delete the same information. So it's a zero possibility.
It's a conspiracy to cover up the crimes they've been committing.
Which, at the very, very least, is obstruction of justice.
Yeah, that's right. And also criminal acts by violating the Records Act and you know, just covering up a crime. All the crimes that they're committing, too, are violations of the criminal law. So, I mean, you know, they should never have had that data to begin with. And if they took our thin thread program, they would never have had it to begin with. So they couldn't have violated it.
You're absolutely right. Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from Maryland by Bill Binney. Bill is a former NSA technical director, and he became a legendary national security whistleblower. Please stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We will be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Twitter on Friday began emailing more than 677,000 people to tell them that they may have interacted with several thousand accounts that Twitter has linked to a Russian bot farm. What was in the automated tweets, and did they sway voters or opinion makers during the election? Nobody knows. We're joined from the San Francisco Bay Area by Steve Patt. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog Left Eye on the News, which you can find at left-eye.blogspot.com. Steve, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
So, Steve, I'm looking at one of these letters. It's three paragraphs long, and the basic point is that the recipient may have either liked or retweeted something that was initially conceived and disseminated by a Russian bot, and then that's it. It says, you know, we're sharing this information so that you can learn more about these accounts and the nature of the Russian propaganda effort. You can see examples of content from these suspended accounts on our blog if you're interested. In fact, you can't see anything. And we don't know what was tweeted. We don't know when it was tweeted. We don't know if there was any impact on anybody. Am I missing something?
Not really. They do have on the Twitter's press release or statement on their blog, whatever you want to call it. They actually have five examples of these tweets. One of the interesting things is one of the five, that's 20%, was something about George Soros, which was tweeted after the election. So that kind of shows how desperate they are to find examples of things that would have influenced the election when one of them was one of the five was after the election. I mean, these tweets that they show, again, you have to presume these are the best examples. They're just silly. I mean, there's one, for example, that shows Bill Clinton and Chelsea Clinton looking anguished during one of the debates. And the tweet reads, "You don't even need the polls. Donald Trump won. You can read it in Bill Clinton's face." Who did that influence? The people who watched the debate presumably formed their own opinion. If you didn't watch the debate, I mean, if you're a Trump supporter or if you're a Clinton supporter, you're going to see this tweet and say, "Oh my God, Hillary lost the debate. I'm voting for Trump." You know, I mean, it's just ludicrous to think that a tweet like this or the other examples that they have had any influence on the election whatsoever.
I'm looking at a couple of others. One is, and the users are just made up names. Pamela Moore is this one, who apparently doesn't exist. It's a picture of a very, very old looking George Soros. And it says, "Retweet if you think that President Trump should put George Soros on the FBI most wanted list. Make America great again." And then there's another one from the ostensibly from the Tennessee GOP, which it's not. But it's a picture of former FBI Director Comey saying, "Resign now. Retweet if you also think that FBI Director Comey should be impeached for blocking the investigation and abetting a criminal." I mean, this is just junk that we see on Twitter and Facebook
and also,
all the time.
And also, we don't, you know, when people say the Russians, you know, like if you said the Americans and everything that came from the United States or any commercial entity, this is a so-called research agency in St. Petersburg, a commercial outfit, apparently. But there's, in other words, there's no proof that this impacted anybody in the elections. And Twitter is not showing other tweets outside of the ridiculous tweets after the election against George Soros. But let's go back to some other facts to show how ludicrous this is. When Congress and its witch hunt were going after Facebook and Twitter about the fact that their platforms had been used by the Russians to meddle in the U.S. elections, both Twitter and Facebook basically said, no big deal. We don't see anything noticeable. And then they were slammed by the Congress. And then in response, Twitter wanted to show it's on the American team, that they didn't want to be slammed by Congress for not doing their part. So Twitter announced that from now on, John, they were going to suspend Sputnik from taking out any more ads with Twitter.
With the keyword being suspend.
And here's another key word. Well, it's not really a key word. It's just a key fact. Sputnik has never taken out an ad with Twitter.
Not a one.
Not one. So guess what? Before the 2016 election campaign, Twitter came to RT and offered to do a big package with RT, magnifying the reach of RT in order to cover the 2016 elections. And it was RT that said no to Twitter because the deal was too expensive. Now they're turning around in the face of this witch hunt in Congress and saying, oh, yeah, Twitter and Facebook did have this outsized influence using Russia Today, and Sputnik had this outsized influence using our platforms. And now we have to alert, in the case of Twitter, 677,000 users. And it says, as Steve mentioned, we are sharing this information so that you can learn more about these accounts and the nature of the Russian propaganda effort without giving people the actual evidence of the tweets that they saw that would have indicated that influence. Now, that's a witch hunt, Steve, Pat.
Exactly. And one of the things that's really striking about the Twitter announcement and the way it's been covered in the press, Twitter says there's 3,814 IRA, that's the Internet Research Agency, linked accounts. And linked accounts is kind of, we don't even know what that means, how they are linked to this Internet Research Agency. But anyway, there's 3,814 accounts which posted 175,993 tweets. But then their sentence continues, approximately 8.4% of which were election related. So you say, what? So 92%, 91.6% of these tweets that they're horrified about had nothing to do with the election. And you can guess that when it comes to classifying something as election related, they were as generous as possible. So 9 out of 10 of the tweets from these accounts had nothing to do with the election. And yet we're going to magnify this. If you work out the math, and this is interesting, 15,000 tweets, and that this over a 10-week period that Twitter was using, that's 200 tweets per day spread over 3,800 accounts, which works out to 0.06 tweets per day per account. So you'd have to have been following 16 of these IRA-linked accounts just to see one tweet per day of these allegedly, influential tweets.
This reminds me of the accusation that the Russians somehow propagandized the American electorate by taking out $100,000 in Facebook ads when, as it turned out, well, first of all, $100,000 is nothing. It's petty cash for any intelligence operation. But besides that, half of that money was spent after the election was over, and then the rest of it was targeted, for whatever reason, in states that did not have a contested election, states that were either solidly blue or solidly red, so it didn't even really matter. And then we saw in the minority report from the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that some of these Facebook messages and Twitter messages tried to propagandize people by posting pictures of puppies and kittens with no explanation as to how that was supposed to happen.
I want to ask you, John Kiriakou, and Steve Pad, because we're talking about the influence, the outsized influence of Sputnik and RT on Facebook and Twitter. How much did Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump spend on social media Facebook ads? Take a guess.
A lot.
Okay, a lot is correct.
$100 million.
$10 million.
A lot is correct. And ding, John Kiriakou is closer. John Kiriakou gets the wash machine. It was $81 million. Now they're talking about $100,000 in Facebook ads purchased by some Russian company, 56% of which came after the election. And they're not about the election. They're about Black Lives Matter or gun rights or LGBTQ issues or what American media and the Russia probe are now saying divisive issues, as if the Russians didn't comment about Black Lives Matter, presuming they did, there wouldn't be the issue of racism or the epidemic of police violence or the epidemic of police killing, as if this could be manufactured by a Russian bot somewhere, and that's what's animating the American people. I mean, it's such an insult to anyone's intelligence. But I have to say, I think a lot of people, when they see Twitter has sent out letters to 677,000 account holders, that will be the news, and thus affirming the general presumption that there must be something here.
It panics people.
Yeah. Steve, Pat, you get the last word. 1 minute.
And that's why they're exaggerating. That's why they have to make these numbers as large as possible. Why Facebook said there were 3,000 ads instead of 1,400 ads that could have influenced the election. And why Twitter says there were 176,000 tweets instead of 15,000 tweets. They're trying to panic people, make things as, you know, horrible as sounding as possible, when really these were a minute fraction. The total percentage of the Twitter tweets was not 1%, was not 0.1%, was not 0.001%. It was 0.01% of the tweets that went out related to the election. There were 1 billion tweets went out relating to the election on Twitter. 15,000 of them were allegedly coming from this IRA account.
I suspect we're going to be bombarded by more of this mainstream propaganda in the coming
weeks. I want Steve
Pat
to come back and help us again in the future with decimals and fractions, because you're doing a great job, Steve.
Thank you. It is one of my specialties.
Excellent.
Steve, thanks for joining us. That was Steve Pat. He joined us from the San Francisco Bay Area. Steve is an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News, which you can find at lefti.blogspot.com. Please stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We will be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The United States is arming and training neo-Nazis in Ukraine, all while Congress is debating a prohibition on doing just that. We're joined in the studio by Max Blumenthal. He is a journalist and best-selling author whose latest book is The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. He is also the senior editor of Alternet's Gray Zone Project and co-host of the podcast Moderate Rebels. Max, thanks for joining us.
Great to be on with you.
Max, we're talking about real neo-Nazis here, violent armed ones who are not just Ukrainian, but also going to Ukraine from elsewhere in Europe. Can you explain to our listeners what's going on?
Well, in 2014, when the, you know, after the coup removed the corrupt but democratically elected President Viktor Yanukovych from Kiev, a civil war erupted in eastern Ukraine. And one of the toughest units representing Kiev, which was at the time a militia that, you know, was not incorporated into the Ukrainian military, but was doing some serious fighting and, you know, performing very well on the battlefield, very ideologically motivated, was the Azov Battalion. Azov Battalion happened to be, at the very least, ultra-nationalist in its ideological composition, but also comprised heavily of neo-Nazis, including foreign fighters, and it recruits foreign fighters and has recruited foreign fighters the way that ISIS has from across Europe among, you know, wayward youth. So the Azov Battalion, which was initially led by someone named Andrei Beletsky, who's a veteran fascist organizer. He now leads the Social National Assembly in Ukraine's parliament. So he's an outspoken neo-Nazi You know, he has pledged to outlaw through his party any interracial contact, and in his words, vowed to prepare Ukraine for further expansion, the struggle for the liberation of the entire white race from the domination of internationalist speculative capital, which you could kind of read as, you know, code for Judaism, international Jewry, as Hitler might have put it. Beletsky, you know, has maintained close ties to the government and to an international neo-Nazi movement in Europe. Azov maintains a semi-underground outfit called the Misanthropic Division, which has recruited neo-Nazi youth at Nazi rock festivals in France, Germany, and Scandinavia. They bring foreign fighters to their camps in eastern Ukraine and allow them to train with heavy weapons. Mikhail Skillet, who's a former Swedish army sniper, who's become a neo-Nazi volunteer for Azov, who has pledged to, you know, liberate the white countries, which is true to the Azov narrative, is a trainer and has been a trainer at these camps. Another person who passed through Azov training camps is a French farmhand named Grégoire Monteau. In June 2016, Monteau was arrested on Ukraine's border by the country's intelligence services with an arsenal of assault rifles, thousands of rounds of ammunition, TNT. He'd even gotten two grenade launchers. And what I learned recently and what we've learned recently is that those grenade launchers may have been made in the United States, because the Azov Battalion, since it's been incorporated formally by the Ukrainian Interior Ministry, has come into possession of hundreds of PSRL-1 grenade launchers, anti-tank grenade launchers modeled after the Russian RPG, made by a Texas-based company called Airtronic, authorized by the State Department and the U.S. Embassy in Ukraine. So the U.S. is directly arming neo-Nazis who function basically as white cis, the white version of ISIS, and have actually been connected to a terror plot aimed at synagogues, mosques, and a European soccer tournament that could have killed hundreds.
You published a piece at therealnews.com, which goes into detail on this. I was struck by what you learned about this Grégoire Monteau. If the rest of these neo-Nazi fighters are anything like this guy, there's a serious problem brewing, not just for Ukraine, but really for the whole of Europe. You say that, driven by his hardcore neo-Nazi ideology, his plan was to blow up a Muslim mosque, a Jewish synagogue, tax collection organizations, police patrol units, and then to attack, as you said a moment ago, the Euro 2016 soccer championship. He had been in communication with military units fighting in Donbass, the eastern Ukrainian area where Azov maintains its training camps. We have to assume that there are other people like him. He can't be the only person who was this heavily armed and this advanced in his planning, right?
Yeah, I mean, the far right is rising in Europe. I witnessed and filmed a neo-Nazi march in Finland. For the real news, it was on Finnish Independence Day, and I watched as 1,000 hardcore neo-Nazis, literal skinheads with bomber jackets, carried torches through the center of Helsinki and marched to the graves of soldiers who had fought in World War II alongside the Nazi SS against the Soviet Union to pay homage to them. The police protected these Nazis. The police fired rubber bullets at anarchists and anti-fascists who attempted to interrupt the march. And basically, the march was a giant success, with the neo-Nazis ending it by chanting, "Thank you, police." This is happening throughout Europe. In Scandinavia, it's a particular problem. And through the Azov Battalion, and these neo-Nazi militias in the East, youth who participate in neo-Nazi mobilization in Western Europe are able to gain training in heavy weapons, including tanks. And that should trouble everyone, along with the prospect that a full-scale war could break out in Eastern Ukraine any day now.
The United States government keeps pursuing a policy of my enemy's enemy is my friend, and their enemy in the case of Eastern Europe or Ukraine and Russia is Russia. And so the Azov Brigade, these fascists who helped overthrow a corrupt but democratically elected government on February 22nd, 2014, they were heralded by the Obama State Department and by John McCain. It was a very bipartisan effort, a new day for Ukraine, they said, a new day. And Victoria Nuland boasted that the U.S. had spent $5 billion since 1991 to promote democracy in Ukraine. Now, Max Blumenthal is our guest. He just wrote about this because the U.S. is debating, how many weapons to sell to these same forces in Ukraine. You open your article, Max, with these words. Last November, an American military inspection team visited the Azov Battalion on the front lines of the Ukrainian civil war to discuss logistics and deepening cooperation. Images of the encounter showed American Army officers poring over maps with their Ukrainian counterparts, the Azov Brigade fascists, palling around and ignoring the Nazi-inspired wolf angel patches emblazoned on their speeches, on their sleeves. I mean, I think most Americans would be, if they actually paid attention and knew, would be quite startled that they are going to spend their tax dollars to fund and finance lethal arms, serious arms, heavy arms to forces, including Nazis in the Ukraine.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at the Azov Battalion logo, behind the wolf's angel is the Sonnengrad, the black sun, which is inspired by SS, Nazi SS insignia. It's recognized by the Anti-Defamation League as an anti-Semitic symbol. And if you look at the marchers who stormed through Charlottesville last year and actually committed lethal acts of terror against anti-fascists, they were waving Sonnengrad flags. This is a symbol of international transatlantic Nazism. It's on a patch on the arm of an officer who is shaking hands with an American Army officer in the field who is there to provide him with logistical support. And now we know from several sources, including the NATO-funded Atlantic Council, military support in the form of these grenade launchers. In addition, the Trump administration has broken with U.S. protocol on supporting the Minsk Accords between Russia and government in Kiev, and supplied the Ukrainian military with Raytheon-manufactured Javelin anti-tank missiles, the most advanced anti-tank missiles in the U.S. arsenal, which will absolutely escalate the conflict. These weapons will, now we can pretty much say with reasonable authority that those advanced anti-tank weapons are likely to wind up in the hands of Azov as well. So yes, your tax dollars are funding neo-Nazis. I mean, if you're out there trying to punch Nazis in the street, you're not going to be able to reach the people who are actually supplying weapons to Nazis because there are just too many levels of security around the Pentagon.
And a bipartisan effort.
Absolutely. It's a bipartisan effort. There are elements trying to stop it in Congress. Representative John Conyers has been a particularly courageous voice since 2015. He has attempted to place a provision in the Defense Authorization Act explicitly forbidding arms to the Azov Battalion. That language remains in there, but it hasn't been passed. And there's opposition from the Pentagon, and I assume, I've actually been told by some sources, opposition from the Ukrainian embassy in the U.S., because this is, again, their frontline fighting unit against pro-Russian separatists,
and
Nazis.
I'm seeing reports in the media, John, whereby John Conyers is being described as a possible Russia stooge because he doesn't want American tax dollars to fund Nazi organizations and militias.
It's the new McCarthyism, like we've talked about.
He was called Putin's man in Congress by a former Bush Pentagon official.
There it is right there.
Just for trying to stop our money from going to literal Nazis. We also have to recognize this relationship extends all the way back to after World War II. Through the CIA, through Operation Paperclip, the rehabilitation of Nazi collaborators and use of them. Figures like Mykola Lebed, who was trained by the Gestapo, was involved in the slaughter of Jews in Krakow. The OUNB, Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, which slaughtered Jews in the city of Lviv in one of the most notorious pogroms of World War II. These figures were brought in droves into the United States, and they worked through CIA front groups like the Prologue Research Corporation, a publishing house in the U.S. The relationship is coming full circle as Russophobia and Russia hysteria rises. The U.S. is returning to its old Cold War allies who are essentially ideologically Nazis.
Yeah, they were the enemies of the Soviet Union, and thus they became the friends of the United States.
And in Syria, we turn to Salafi jihadists, and we've learned through British researchers that arms, U.S. arms, were relied upon extensively by ISIS. The province of Idlib is controlled by al-Qaeda, and that would not have been possible without...
We did the same thing in Afghanistan with the sale of, or the provision of Stinger missiles to anti-Soviet fighters. Those Absolutely. Anti-Soviets formed the genesis of Al-Qaeda. And then we had to embark on a multi-million-dollar program to try to buy back those Stinger right. missiles before they were used against us.
Right. That's when Osama bin Laden was a freedom fighter. I mean, according to American media
yeah, that's
at
right.
that time. Anyway, last word, Max Blumenthal.
This is a scandalous episode of American collusion with neo-Nazi elements to achieve a cynical geopolitical goal, and the scandal has passed completely under the radar as we focused on the government shutdown.
So true. We will leave it there, but this is undoubtedly another topic we're going to come back to. We were joined in the studio by Max Blumenthal. He's a journalist and best-selling author whose latest book is The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. He is also the senior editor of Alternet's Gray Zone Project and co-host of the podcast Moderate Rebels. I'd like to point people to his article on this topic at therealnews.com. It's entitled The U.S. is Arming and Assisting Neo-Nazis in Ukraine While Congress Debates Prohibition. Please stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Just days after the Trump administration announced that it would allow states to compel poor people to work, federal health officials granted Kentucky permission to impose those requirements. We're joined in studio by Leonardo Cuello. He's an attorney, and he's the director of health policy for the National Health Law Program. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So this is not as simple as just allowing a waiver for Kentucky. It's also requiring poor people to pay $15 a month for their health care, and it's doing away with basic dental and vision insurance unless people participate in some sort of an extra, what they're calling a health rewards program. Can you walk our listeners through exactly what this Kentucky plan is?
Sure. So the Kentucky plan is a series of waivers, and they actually have more than you could probably list. So one of them, the one that has gotten the most attention, is a work requirement, which basically means that everybody has to document, submit paperwork showing that they are either working or meeting an exception. And if they fail to do that, they get terminated from the program. But in addition to that, you have what we call the lockout, which is a provision that basically says normally the state is required to enroll everybody who is eligible. But Kentucky has been given permission to lock people out of coverage for 6 months if they fail to make a premium payment or they fail to actually even submit basic paperwork, meaning they're locked out of coverage. They actually can't get back into coverage. You also have a premium requirement. Medicaid, under the law, prohibits premiums for anybody who is below 150% of the federal poverty level. So if you're living in poverty, you should never have a premium in Medicaid. Kentucky will be charging premiums. Medicaid law requires states to provide transportation assistance to low-income people who have difficulties making it to the doctor's office because they don't have transportation. Either they can't afford public transportation or they live in a rural area where there is no transportation and they don't have a car. And the Trump administration is also allowing Kentucky not to provide transportation. So what these waivers are taken in total is essentially the Trump administration allowing Kentucky not to comply with federal requirements that help guarantee access to care for individuals in the program.
This is potentially catastrophic for families, especially for the working poor, people with children, no?
It is. And Kentucky's own analysis, the state's own analysis, this is in their application, so this is not a disputed fact. Their own analysis shows that 100,000 people will lose their coverage, will be terminated from coverage because of this. In addition to that, of course, you have people who won't be terminated, but will be in the program and don't have transportation to actually get to their doctor or are subject to this ER copayment system that they have that will be unaffordable to them and scare them off of actually going to the ER, even when they have an emergency that needs treatment. So the cost in human lives of this is dramatic. And remember that Kentucky is basically ground zero here. It's the first state that has requested this. We know an approval for almost the exact same thing is coming in Indiana in a matter of days. And we have Wisconsin, Arizona, Arkansas, other states all waiting in the wings. So, you know, this is the first in a series of moves that the Trump administration will make to really create a regression in terms of access to healthcare for people in Medicaid. And let's remember who we're talking about here. Medicaid enrollees are people who are low income and children, pregnant women, older adults, right? The people who are going to be impacted by these policies are veterans with PTSD.
Sure.
We're talking about homeless people. You know, we are just talking about the most vulnerable people in society who we are stripping healthcare away from.
Before the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, what was it like or what was required to receive Medicaid?
So to be eligible for Medicaid, you not only have to be low income, but you have to fit into one of the categories of eligibility. So you had to be low income and disabled, or low income and elderly, or low income and pregnant. And there was no category for just average Joe or Jane, right? And so what really changed under the Affordable Care Act is they created one new category, and that new category is everybody else, right? And so what was supposed to happen is that new mandatory category was supposed to be in effect in all the states, meaning now everybody who was living in poverty was going to be covered regardless of whether they fit into one of those little boxes. And what happened is that the Supreme Court decision in a case called NFIB, in that case, the Supreme Court basically said, we are not going to allow HHS to punish any state that doesn't do the Medicaid expansion. So effectively, that expansion is still required, but there's no punishment. It's like telling your teenager, your curfew is midnight, but if you come in later than midnight, there's no punishment. So some of the states, in fact, the majority, 31, have gone ahead and expanded Medicaid, but you have other states that haven't. So we essentially have 60% of the states where now we really are in a position where, you know, everybody who's living in poverty, and we put an asterisk on everybody because, of course, there are immigrants and other communities we care about a lot that don't get coverage, but everybody who could be eligible for Medicaid is in. And then you have this 40% of states where we still have the anachronistic system where if you don't fit into one of those little boxes, you don't get covered.
Yeah, you know, I'm looking at a piece in the Hill newspaper right now, and it says that there are several advocacy groups that are planning a lawsuit to try to block Kentucky's implementation of this waiver. Are you involved in any of these planned lawsuits? Even if you're not, what do you think of the possibility that the court's intervention can make this thing right again?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question. We are certainly very involved in that. We've been talking right a lot about how this is a terrible policy, right? It also turns out it's totally illegal. The authority that the Trump administration is using to do this is an authority that is supposed to be a limited authority to do innovations in healthcare that will improve access to health services. As we've discussed, none of these things actually improve access to health services. So they actually are not legal. We are looking very, very closely at the approval that was issued with, you know, and examining the possibility of taking legal action. And as a separate statement, I'll just say that given how contrary to the law many of these provisions are, and we could talk about why in more detail, but given how illegal they are, lawsuits are inevitable.
Let's talk about the politics of this. The Kentucky governor is Matt Bevin, Republican.
Yeah,
Trump supporter.
Very conservative.
Trump was made Kentucky and coal industry a big part of his campaign, his base. Kentucky was a big beneficiary of the Affordable Care Act with Medicaid expansion. For many, many people in Kentucky, especially poor people, and there are many poor people in Kentucky, and many poor people in Kentucky are poor because there's no longer employment in coal mines, so the two go together. They now were able to have health care. For many, it was health care for the first time. Now, the Republican governor is promising them that he will take away their health care. In the good old days, politicians promised, even if it was demagogically, to improve people's lives. What's the politics for a Republican governor, supporter of Trump, taking away the health care coverage for poor people in a state that voted for Trump and voted for the Republican Party?
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the major ironies of this whole thing, right, is that during the campaign, the talking point was these people in Kentucky and other states, these poor people, they need jobs. We got to get them jobs. They don't have jobs. We need to get them jobs. And now it's, if you're not working, we're going to take away your health care. So if your premise earlier was the jobs aren't available, how can you turn to people and say, we're going to take away your job if you're not working? So there's a glaring contradiction in the politics right there up front. In terms of how this plays politically, the key point is, right, how this narrative gets twisted and turned. If you let the narrative be, hey, people should be working, well, everybody agrees with that, right? We all want people to be able to find jobs and start working. What you need to do is really tell the full story about what this is, right? This is an administrative burden that is going to hit everybody in the program. The people who are working are going to need to submit paperwork to prove they're working. Some of them are going to get terminated. People who are caretakers, people who are disabled are going to need to submit paperwork. Some of them are going to get terminated. So this is not about getting people work, right? Because they've already stipulated that the jobs aren't there. This is about cutting healthcare. And if people in the state understand that, I think the tide will turn dramatically against Governor Bevin when 100,000 people lose their healthcare. That's certainly going to cause him problems. But if Governor Bevin is able to dominate the narrative and contort the facts, then it's going to be challenging for
us. He's putting this out there as what he's calling a great and transformational change for the state of Kentucky. That this is somehow a magic wand that is going to force everybody who's not working to go to work, and magically somehow these jobs will appear.
And the premise is to demonize the poor.
Absolutely, it always is.
Yeah, and I'll just tell you that you can actually look at the facts on this, and we actually have facts showing mandatory work requirements, forcing people to work, is not effective at creating stable long-term employment. And you know what is effective? Giving them voluntary job supports, training opportunities, that actually creates stable long-term employment.
That is money well spent.
Bevin said, why should a working age person not be expected to do something in exchange for what they are provided? So you're sick. Maybe you have cancer. Maybe you have a chronic illness. Maybe your kids are sick. You have to do something. You have to show 80 hours of something, some work somewhere, so that your kid can go to a doctor or so that you can go to a doctor. I mean, the barbarism and cruelty of this kind of logic, this kind of plan. And the fact is, it's not an intellectual right-wing policy wonk thing going on. This is actually going to be happening to people. You get the last word, 30 seconds.
And it's exactly backwards, because it's not that people work to be healthy, right? It's that you give people healthcare, you make them healthy, and you enable them to do all these other things. So they are just putting the cart before the horse.
And who doesn't want to be a productive member of society? Well, this is a very important issue that we will undoubtedly revisit in the very near future. We were joined here in the studio by Leonardo Cuello. He is an attorney and the director of health policy for the National Health Law Program. Thanks for joining us. We are happy to have you. Please stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
President Trump's new national defense strategy envisions a world where great power competition with China and Russia is a bigger threat to the United States than terrorism. Have we entered into a new national defense era? We're joined from Sweden by Dr. Jan Åberg. He is the director of the Transnational Foundation for Peace and Future Research. Dr. Åberg, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
We have not heard words like this coming from the Department of Defense since before the September 11th attacks in 2001. Can you tell our listeners how significant this is that the national defense strategy will begin looking at China and Russia rather than at terrorism as the greatest problems facing the United States?
Well, it is quite a long time since there was such a defense strategy published, and I guess they have said to themselves, well, we got to present something new, or switch balances between different challenges or threat perceptions. And, you know, the way the United States has behaved the last few years, it has been a 50-50 between, you know, fighting what the elites in Washington think are the threats, such as Russia, Iran, North Korea, and whatever have you we don't like, and the other one being fighting the global war on terrorism, which, of course, is related to each other. So I'm not that surprised. I don't think it signifies any, you know, very big change in anything.
You know, one of the interesting things here is that the mainstream media in the United States is largely ignoring this. And I wonder if that's part of the plan, that the important thing is to negotiate budgets with the Congress rather than to frighten the American people into thinking that the world is changing and we're behind the eight ball.
Let me say it this way, you know, intellectually, it's not worth discussing this plan. I would see it as a narrative that has repeated itself basically with some other different names over the years, but it's the same narrative built on the same kind of module as we've had the last 30, 40, 50 years. And that's what any defense ministry around the world does, because it's the most conservative. It's the places where intellectual, the least new thinking is coming up. The whole world is changing, and these guys, whether it's in this Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Pentagon, or my own in Sweden or whatever, there's no new thoughts. I mean, this is, if you want peace, prepare for war. Now, have you heard this before? It is threats, countries that are threatening, the description of which is simply nothing but psychopolitical projection of what we do ourselves much more. It is stupid stuff like we want to protect our values, our freedoms, and our way of life. Now, the only means you cannot use to do that would be weapons. What you need to defend these things would be education, culture, cooperation in the world. It's the old hat again that defense means military. And military in this sense means not only military means, no civilian means, no civil protection, no nonviolence, no cooperation. Defense means military. And that is military that is strong and has supremacy over everybody else. Now, there's one time where the word cooperation in the international community is mentioned, and that is we are ready to cooperate, but from a position of strength with anyone.
They use the words to return to dominance. Dr. Oberg, I agree with much of what you say, but I want to just sort of take issue a little bit with what you're saying. I mean, these documents, yes, all governments use these sort of platitudes to explain and justify and rationalize pouring huge parts of the national treasury into the military-industrial complex or down the rat hole of weapons production. But by focusing the public's attention on Russia and China as a menace, and coming as it does where the U.S. has adopted a very aggressive military posture in Asia called the Asia Pivot, whereby the U.S. will deploy 60% of its U.S. naval and air force assets to the Pacific region by 2020, and during a time in which the Americans are told that Russia, the Russian government, with all sorts of nefarious aims, is interfering in, meddling in, colluding with players in America and in exercising an undue influence in American politics. It seems to me that by coming out now, with Mattis coming out now with Russia and China as the principal protagonists, it sends a message to the American people about who to hate and who to fear. It also sends a message about U.S. Intentions regarding both Russia and China. And I'm looking at Chinese media. They're not taking this lightly at all. They are condemning it as not an aggression, but sort of preparing for an aggressive policy by the U.S. in and around China. Go ahead.
Well, there's one interesting sentence in the summary of this plan, and that is roughly quoting like this. For decades, the United States could do what it wanted, where it wanted, and in whichever way it chose to do. Now we can't. Now, you see, this one is coming the year 2018. For a long time, it's been obvious that the U.S. empire, and perhaps even the republic, is falling apart. The relative strength of the United States is going down rapidly compared with the 50s, 60s, and 70s in terms of moral power, legal power, political power, cultural power, with the exception probably still where they are second to none in terms of military power. So what they see is a China that is coming in terms of the Silk Road projects, in terms of a huge economic expansion, having lifted up 400 million people out of poverty, and people listening more and more to what's happening horizontally in this world, that is kind of, you know, is a vision of the future. You know, the Chinese have a vision which is something like, you know, 100 years or more ahead, whereas we have something which might be 4 years in the best of cases if Trump lasts that long. So all this comes from the situation in which you think you begin to see that you're becoming weaker. And that means you have to emphasize where this main challenge from your world position is. And terrorism, whatever we think about it, is not yet threatening that world.
Dr. Oberg, we have about 90 seconds left. I agree with you on that point. I want to read a headline from the U.S. Department of Defense, coming as it does, about the release of the National Defense Strategy. Here it is. DOD official, quote, "National Defense Strategy will rebuild dominance, enhance deterrence." Now, when the United States, with its vast military prowess and a huge military machine, it spends more on military than the next, I don't know, eight countries combined, asserts that it's going to overcome its contemporary weaknesses that you've well documented by, quote, rebuilding dominance. That's pretty threatening to the rest of the world. And if Russia and China are identified as the countries that must be dominated by the rebuilding of dominance, it seems to me to put the United States on a collision course, no?
Yeah, but I mean, it's not that many years ago you had the full spectrum dominance also. I mean, dominance has been a word that has been used since 45. I think this whole report is coming out of a sense of weakness and a lack of ability to change course and say, well, we've got to cooperate with the rest of the world. Wherever you see what Trump has done the last 1 year, and to a certain extent Obama before him, was to isolate the United States. It's not that there's a vision. It's not that there's something you can make other people enthusiastic about. People find it dangerous and slightly ridiculous at the moment. I mean, we have to deal with foreign policy in terms of a president who makes Twitter is more or less absurd. So I think that you're right. From the other perspective, from the rest of the world, this looks threatening. To me, it looks like a cry. We know we're getting weaker. And you know, if they really want to spend more money on militarism, that will only speed up the falling apart and the economic falling apart of the empire. The best the United States could do now would be to cooperate and disarm to survive with its dominance or its supremacy.
Well, that would be a benign outcome, but it seems to me that they may be on a different pathway, not cooperation. They're going in a different direction. We'll see, though. I agree, coming from a position of weakness, but there's a lot of money to be spent,
a lot
of weapons to be purchased, a lot of forward basing of military forces towards China, towards Russia. We see that expansion of NATO. I believe it's a threatening period that we're in.
Or it will mean the militarization to death. The Soviet Union fell apart in that. The British fell apart because of that. Why should the United States not fall apart because of over-militarization? It's hellishly expensive to maintain 600 bases plus in 130 countries.
We will have to leave that as the last word. That was Dr. Jan Oberg, who joined us from Sweden. He's the director of the Transnational Foundation for Peace and Future Research. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us here at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear. Oh.
love home.